I had learned from gentle Penthe of the existence of unfaith, and had accepted it as a reality even though it frightened her, she had been able to look at Cossill much more steadily and to understand her. Cossill had no true worship in her heart of the nameless ones or of the gods. She held nothing sacred but power. The emperor of the Kargad lands now held the power, and therefore he was indeed a god-king in her eyes, and she would serve him well. But to her the temples were mere show, the tombstones were rocks, the tombs of Atuan were dark holes in the ground, terrible but empty. She would do away with the worship of the empty throne if she could. She would do away with the first priestess if she dared. Arha had come to face even this last fact quite steadily. Perhaps Thar had helped her to see it, though she had never said anything directly. In the first stages of her illness, before the silence came upon her, she had asked Arha to come to her every few days, and had talked to her, telling her much of the doings of the god-king and his predecessor, and the ways of Awabath. Matters which she should, as an important priestess, know, but which were not often flattering to the god-king and his court. And she had spoken of her own life, and described what the Arha of the previous life had looked like and done, and sometimes, not often, she had mentioned what might be the difficulties and dangers of Arha's present life. Not once did she mention Cossill by name. But Arha had been Thar's pupil for 11 years, and needed no more than a hint or a tone to understand and to remember. After the gloomy commotion of the rites of mourning was over, Arha took to avoiding Cossill. When the long works and rituals of the day were done, she went to her solitary dwelling, and whenever there was time, she went to the room behind the throne, and opened the trap door, and went down into the dark. In daytime and nighttime, for it made no difference there, she pursued a systematic exploration of her domain. The undertomb, with its great weight of sacredness, was utterly forbidden to any but priestesses and their most trusted eunuchs. Any other, man or woman, who ventured there would certainly be struck dead by the wrath of the nameless ones. But among all the rules she had learned, there was no rule forbidding entry to the labyrinth. There was no need. It could be entered only from the undertomb. And anyway, do flies need rules to tell them not to enter in a spider's web? So she took Manon often into the nearer regions of the labyrinth, that he might learn the ways. He was not at all eager to go there, but, as always, he obeyed her. She made sure that Dubi and Uato, Cossel's eunuchs, knew the way to the Room of Chains and the way out of the undertomb, but no more. She never took them into the labyrinth. She wanted no one but Manon, utterly faithful to her, to know those secret ways, for they were hers, hers alone, forever. She had begun her full exploration with the labyrinth. All the autumn she spent many days walking those endless corridors, and still there were regions of them she had never come to. There was a weariness in that tracing of the vast, meaningless web of ways. The legs got tired and the mind got bored, forever reckoning up the turnings and the passages behind and to come. It was wonderful, laid out in the solid rock underground like the streets of a great city. But it had been made to weary and confuse the mortal walking it, and even its priestess must feel it to be nothing, in the end, but a great trap. So more and more as winter deepened, she turned her thorough exploration to the hall itself, the altars, the alcoves behind and beneath the altars, the rooms of chests and boxes, the contents of the chests and boxes, the passages and attics, the dusty hollow under the dome where hundreds of bats nested, the basements and under-basements that were the anterooms of the corridors of darkness. Her hands and sleeves, perfumed with the dry sweetness of a musk that had fallen to powder lying for 8 centuries in an iron chest, her brow smeared with the clinging black of cobweb, she would kneel for an hour to study the carvings on a beautiful, time-ruined coffer of cedar wood, the gift of some king ages since to the nameless powers of the tombs. There was the king, a tiny stiff figure with a big nose, and there was the hall of the throne, with its flat dome and porch columns, carved in delicate relief on the wood by some artist who had been dust for how many hundred years. There was the one priestess, breathing in the drug fumes from the trays of bronze and prophesying, or advising the king, whose nose was broken off in this frame. The face of the priestess was too small to have clear features, yet Arha would imagine that the face was her own face. She wondered what she had told the king with the big nose, and whether he had been grateful. She had favorite places in the hall of the throne, as one might have favorite spots to sit in a sunny house. She often went to a little half-loft over one of the robing rooms in the hinder part of the hall. There, ancient gowns and costumes were kept, left from the days when great kings and lords came to worship at the place of the tombs of Atuan, acknowledging a domain greater than their own or any man's. Sometimes their